The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey, Pantheon listeners. Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 83 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast, with a new episode released every single day. You get a big name extended interview like this one every Monday, and short 4 or 5 minute daily episodes Tuesday through Sunday on a show that I call This Day Rocks. If this is your first time listening, please find Vintage Rock Pod on your podcast app or player of choice and subscribe directly on there so you don't miss a single episode. As I said, one comes out every single day, and you can only get all those episodes on the Vintage Rock Pod feed, so give it a like or subscribe separately on there too, please. Now, today's interview is an extended one. You know that usually my interview shows run around the half-hour mark, you know, 25, maybe 40 minutes max. Well, today's is considerably longer, so strap in. My guest was incredibly open and honest about his career, his life, and more. And yes, he's another Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, lead singer with the 60s Merseybeat band The Hollies, Alan Clark. The band were massive in the UK in this period. They burst onto the scene in the early 60s, and between 63 and 70 had 16 top 10 singles here alone. 11 of those were top 5, and one, I'm Alive, went to number one as well. Incredibly successful band. Now, the group in those early days consisted of Alan on lead vocals, Eric Haydock, then Bernie Calvert on bass, Tony Hicks on lead guitar, Bobby Elliott on drums, and Graham Nash on rhythm guitar. Yes, the same Graham Nash who left to form Crosby, Stills and Nash, and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. In fact, Alan and Graham were best friends from the age of just 6, and when Graham left in 1969, Alan took it really hard, as you'd expect, and he's very honest in this interview about that time. Now, thankfully, they are back, and Graham has worked with Alan for the first time in decades on Alan's new album, which you'll hear all about as well. Honestly, it's a fascinating conversation, as Alan also tells stories about working with the Beatles, the big hits, of course, a funny trip to Vegas to see Elvis live, giving up the music business for 20 years fearing he couldn't sing again, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, and much, much more. I really hope you enjoy this deep and fascinating chat with the lead singer of one of the biggest UK groups of the early 60s. Here's my chat with Alan Clark from The Hollies. Obviously, you met Graham Nash when you were just 6 years old. You've been friends ever since, and you've combined again on your new album, I'll Never Forget, which is due for release on BMG on April 7th. Now, we've got our first taste of the record on the track Buddy's Back, and it's you and Graham, and you're back together harmonising as well for the first time in decades. So let's start here. I mean, talk to me about this song and how all this came together.
Graham and I have been trying to get back together, or I have been trying to get back together with Graham for a long, long time. Whenever we meet, or we weren't used to meet in the past, it was, you know, someday we better do something together. This is after the 1984 thing that we did with him. And there was just one day I was asked to give him a presentation. a lifetime achievement presentation in London, but I did it secretly, and I hadn't seen him for years. So when it did happen, it was I was in the gods, of course, in the theatre, and then they took me down to the side of the stage, and then they introduced me to go on to present this to Graham. Graham was in the audience, and he obviously didn't know. So I did my little spiel about how wonderful it was to have a friend like Graham Nash. And he came up and he gave me a big hug. And he said, "It's nice to see you again, Al. It's nice being together." And I think that was, I think we, it was like we touched emotionally and all that, you know. It was really, really wild. But after that, I saw him quite a lot. I used to meet him in London at his hotel. And he was very interested in the album that I did, Resurgence, which is the album that I did before. So I went down, we had a chat, and I let him listen to it. And he said, "Hey, that sounds really great, wonderful." Not saying anything else, you know. So I thought, okay, he likes the album, that's good enough. That's one step forward. So after the next, you know, couple of years, what happened was that I got hold of Graham again. I says, "Look, I've got this song. Do you fancy doing it? Doing an album?" And he said, "Yeah, send me the song," which I did. And it's one that's on the album, and it's called "I'll Never Forget." And I wrote the song lyrically trying to say that this might happen, it might not happen. Like here we are finding ourselves in a peculiar situation and wondering whether what we're trying to do is going to happen, and what will it be like if it does happen. And what will happen after that if it does this and if it does that? So it was about a hesitation song about, you know, are we going to do it or aren't we going to do it? So I sent it to Graham and he liked it. And he said, "Let's do it." So that was the actual start of doing the album. Obviously, everything else had happened around the world, like COVID. And we were still, you know, no one's able to travel and do anything. It's a shame, really, because I would have liked to have written with Graham, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. with the album, but that we couldn't do that. So we got that one song under our belt, and I sent him another couple of stuff, which he liked. And then halfway through, he said, "Alan," he said, "I think this should be your solo album." He said, "Because you're really in good voice now." He said, "This is really good that you're doing this. And I will put all the harmonies on." And I said to him, "Well, you've got to write something, you know, about it." And he said, "Don't worry, I'll write a song." And he came up with "Buddy's Back." And what that actually says in 2.5 minutes was the complete start of our love with Buddy Holly, taking it right through, you know, going through, like, even looking in a mirror, pretending to be them, you know, to the part where it led us to call ourselves right at the end Buddy Holly, but having him in the beginning of our life in musically, you know, and actually calling the group the Hollies after that. And he's done a wonderful job. He sent me the song and he says, "You do what you think right with it." So with my producer, we fiddled about it, you know, and made just a little bit more reference to Buddy Holly with the drum sound and everything like that. And I sent that back to him. I said, "What do you think?" He says, "That's going to sound great on the album." So that's what we did. And that's how we planned the album, and that's how we recorded it. With me sort of doing my demo of the song and then me sending my demo down to my producer, and my producer throwing my demo away, really, but put what he thought was, kept a few guitar licks here and there, you know, but then started working on the song. And I was able to actually go down at that particular time, going out COVID-free, et cetera. So we worked on the backing tracks and then put my vocal on, some of my vocals I did up here, and just sent them down. And then we sent that finished thing over to Graham, and then he did his harmonies over there in his studio with Tug Caldwell, who is his client co-producer. And then he sent it back and says, "How's that?" And I said, "Great, but maybe you can double that harmony up." So I made him work, you know, and that was it. And that's how it went along with the tracks. And most of the tracks can be, you can hear the involvement of Graham in most of the lyrics. There's only a few where you don't, you know, but I do refer to Graham mainly when I wrote the songs, listening to what I sing and what in his harmony would sound with my singing. So that was the main aim of getting that sound back.
Yeah.
And I think we actually did it.
Yeah.
And everybody I played it to really like it, you know, especially that, you know, when they've not heard anything like that from us for a long, long time, they instantly say, there it is. That's the sound of the Hollies. And that's what I was trying to achieve. And I think it worked.
Absolutely, absolutely, indeed. It sounds fantastic, like I said, with the harmonising on there. It's a catchy little number as well. So what can we expect from the rest of the album when it comes?
Well, there are sad songs. There are funny songs. There's a song about the world situation.
Hard to avoid.
I don't like political things, you know, but I do. I'm not a guy that would go out on a march. I'm too old for this to do that anyway. You know, a bit late for me to say that. But, you know, I do think that the world's in a funny place. There's a lot of things going on which shouldn't be happening, as we all know. And it was actually a song that I did a song on the last album called The Door Is Slowly Closing, which is actually saying, you better watch out because there's going to be a lot of things happening that you thought would never happen. And just recently that's come true. And not that I'm trying to be, you know, somebody who could read the future or anything like that. Quite obvious, everybody, when you look at nature around you, it's quite obvious. I did have lyrics for this particular song for quite a while. So I put it to music and it's called You Need Someone to Save You. And it's about what's happening to nature. Because you can see it every night now when you look on television, there's always something that's happening somewhere else in the world, which is devastation. You know, and that's not good news. So I just thought that I'd put my two penny thing on how I feel. There must be something that everybody can do, or there must be someone who could bring people together. Everybody keeps sticking a finger in, like Putin and people like that, you know, they keep stopping, you know, what we need to do. That's what that song's about. I wrote a love song for my wife. We'll be married 60 years next year.
Wow.
And she was the original Jennifer Eccles. It's actually a song that I think that everybody can relate to, because I think it's having a person in your life for so long that, you know, the presence of this particular person makes life worth living. And I think that there's thousands and thousands of people I know on the face of the earth that know what the actual word love means, you know. So there's that one. That's my own personal one. And there's things of that way, lyrically.
Wonderful. Yeah. So, Alan Nostradamus, is there a favourite track of yours on the album? I like to put people on the spot and ask them, is there one in particular that stands out to you?
Nostradamus.
Yeah. Predicting the future.
Well, that's the one. That's the one. You know, I've not. Yeah, he's made a few right things, hasn't he? You know, but I hope that he's wrong. You know, about maybe the end. You know, I do wish, you know, and pray for, you know, every night for the willingness of people to stop doing the wrong thing and do the right thing. There's not much I can do about it. You know, I'm only a single person. So the only thing that I can do is just say how I feel about things. There's only that one track on the album. I always state, as I said to Graham when we first started it, I know he's very political in the way that he writes. And I said, I don't want to do any political songs whatsoever. So, you know, I know he writes great songs, you know, but, you know, there was one song that he sent me called Golden Idol, which was, you have to get into the lyrics to find out what it actually means. But in the end, I got into it, and it was heavily political. And I was saying, well, that's one song that I can't really get involved in because it's an American, you know, and you can't start making points about how Americans are running their country. So I stay away from all that sort of stuff, as I do here as well.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, the album went well. You know, we had fun even though we weren't together. We had fun doing FaceTime and things like that. I actually got Graham, when I actually said something that he remembered from the past, he answered me actually into his Mancunian type way of voice. And I said, ah, there you are. You know. So that relationship, we got back in a small way. He hasn't forgotten his roots as well as I haven't forgotten my roots. You know, so we don't see each other enough.
Yeah.
New York's not too far. Maybe I'm coming over to New York and maybe do something over there.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Indeed. Now, it was famous that you took a step out of music, didn't you, for was it 30 years or so, or 20 years, what is it, because of your poor wife had cancer a number of times. And you came back, like you said, you had Resurgence, came out a couple of years ago, and this album now. So you're enjoying being back in the music sphere and recording and putting things out again?
It's very unexpected. I left Ollie's in the end of 1999 for the reason that you quite rightly said. But also, I wasn't hitting the right notes, you know, the high notes, which they were a killer to sing. And I'm like, for the length of time that I was actually doing The Air That I Breathe and He and Heavy and all the other high notes that you have to hit to make it worthwhile, you're doing it. It was getting too much for me at the end, you know, doing 40 years of that stuff. It took its toll. And we, well, I had words with Tony and Bobby, and what they wanted to do actually was they didn't think that I was able to put on a show. And quite rightly, they were. I wasn't able to do what I could do 20 years before or even 10 years before, you know, and that happens to a lot of people in no matter what job you're in.
Of course, I mean, yeah.
I have a car and you're a lorry driver, you're going to give up, you know. So that and Jenny getting cancer again, I said, well, okay, that's it. I can't carry on. So here I go. What's going to happen from now on? But the thing that was what was going to happen was that Jenny and I had to say to ourselves, we don't know what's going to happen in maybe tomorrow or in a year or whatever. We didn't have any idea of how or if she was ever going to be along for that long. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we decided, well, if we're going to do this, let's go somewhere where we can escape to, where we know we're going to be happy and the sun's going to shine. So I bought a house in Hilton Head, which is in South Carolina, because a doctor friend had taken me there before and we both fell in love with it. So we bought a ranch house in South Carolina and we went there for 3 months at a time, you know, and we had a wonderful 6 years there. And, you know, after the 6 years, you say to me, well, why are we doing this now? You know, what's happened? You know, we're both enjoying life. Fortunately for us, our children needed us back home more than just 6 months a year. So we decided to pull up sticks and come back we were actually spending more time with the family in between going over there. But then it was down to, see, my son Toby and my daughter Piper decided to have children. So grandchildren came along, you know, and it was brilliant looking after them in their younger age. I mean, my eldest two are now, Sam? And now we've got two 15-year-olds. You know, which have become a part of our life. You know, because living in a bubble. We have done through since COVID, but you know, living together and not only we're becoming friends. You know, and it's great, it's wonderful. But so you know, after that, I had no intention of doing music. Only the thing that I did with Graham when I went down to the Albert Hall to claim my Buddy Holly Education Foundation guitar, which was great. Because, you know, Phil Everly and I got ours for life. Nobody else did. So, you know, that was good. And actually, Graham forced me to go on stage and sing Bus Stop for a long, long time. And then seeing him at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, which he said, Alan, you got to come over. You know, you say you can't sing, but I'll bet you can when you get over here. Because it overtakes you, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It really does. It's a shame that Tony and Bobby couldn't make it, but they wanted to work instead of doing something which I thought they should have done. Because, you know, not everybody gets into the Rock and Roll. Oh, I mean, Graham got in twice. So might even get in a third time. You never know. Yeah. But it was a wonderful experience. It was great. Met a lot of people. And it gave me just that little bit more confidence in my life, really. You know, because when you're living with a thing that you know all those great songs that you sang, and even now when sometimes you go on television and that clip comes up on YouTube, yeah. And here's this young guy singing "He Ain't Heavy," and they go, "Oh, Frankie." You know, and I look back on that and go, wow, you know, I was blessed, fantastic, lovely. But to relate to that now is that when we were sort of got used to our life as it is, I mean, I got ill with prostate cancer. And it's another one of those things where you have to wait 5 years and you have to go through all the what you have to have done for that type of thing. And your attitude towards life changes. Yeah. So this didn't actually start me making writing lyrics, but it did in a way. I was just up in this room where I am now, and I started writing lyrics, and I wrote a poem, and it sounded pretty good to me. I was quite surprised where it came from. You know, it came quite quickly, and my wife read it, and a few other people read it. And they says, well, why don't you put it to music? And I said, well, first of all, I don't know how to do that because I was a singer. Yeah. And then again, I can't sing. I kept telling myself, you see, that I couldn't sing. And they said, well, why don't you try singing it lower? Which I never thought, you know, that I, you know, why do I do that? So I did. I put music to that particular song. And I sent it to a few friends, and they came back with, "Wow, you should do more." And over a period of going through my cancer treatment and everything, I compiled enough songs that, you know, GarageBand, I didn't even know what it was for, because there was no need for me to use it, you know. But with my son Toby, who teaches performing arts and music. He said to me, there's a thing on you. He says, you've seen me use it. And you said, what are those squiggly lines that go on? He says, well, that's how you do it. So he came up and he loaded my machine and actually taught me how to get the track to him and to actually press the right button at the right time. I had to learn by making mistakes, yeah. You know, losing a track and going, oh my God, track go. And then it's just a simple thing that you can go edit. And you can actually, whatever you've whacked, you can bring it back. So you learn all these things. Like, so I started becoming a producer of music, doing it that way. And in that time, I'd sent there's a guy in America, in Los Angeles, Saul Davis, and his wife, Carla Olson, who's got a group called The Textones, and they're both wonderful people. And they've both been trying to get me to do an album for 20 years. And each time he'd say, don't ask me, I can't sing. Well, because I know him, they're both in the business, and they know what is good and what is bad. I sent my songs over, you know, just to get some sort of reaction. And the reaction was, what are you doing? Why don't you do this properly? You know, get it? Why aren't you doing it? I'm going, well, I don't want to do that. It's just something I'm having fun. And I think that he actually sent these tracks to, he knows all the people there, and he sent it to Hartwig Messer from BMG. And what happened, I get a phone call from BMG, and Hartwig is saying, hello, Alan, how are you? And I thought, well, I'm very well. What can I do for you? I want to put your album out. So you see, Francis and I had got it to a part, like where we thought people told us the demos were good. So Francis Haynes, who was my producer, and he was in the Hollies for a while, and we're great friends. We go right the way back, and he used to do demos for me, and they were brilliant demos. And so I thought, I need that guy. So he came up one day, and I played him the stuff, and he said, yeah, we can do that. And he brought them up to another level, you know. Man was out the window, but, you know, my ideas were there when he done properly. And we got to the point where we finished the album and we gave it to BMG and it was put out. And everybody said, wow, where did that come from? We thought you couldn't sing. Why haven't you been doing it for the last 20 years? Why aren't you on the road? All these type of things, you know, which obviously I couldn't do. And it gave me a lot of confidence within myself. I did a lot of radios. I did a lot of traveling. you know. And as I say, it was accepted, and you know, people said, "Great, you know, oh, Alan's back." I wasn't back, you know, but I'd made an album, and that was it. So, you know, that was 3 years ago now, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So we went through COVID. I got the good news that everything's clear. That was last year.
Fantastic.
And while that was happening in the beginning, I started my second album, you know, just writing stuff. And that's where the track I'll Never Forget came in, and meeting Graham again, and then actually getting to the point where he says, "I want to be involved in your album, but I would do the harmonies and you write the songs and I'll write a song." And that's how it is now. Again, the same questions are thrown at me about, well, what are you going to do about it now? I have no idea. I know that the Buddy song represents what our thoughts back in, you know, the late, when was it? It was about the late 60s. No, what am I talking about? The late 50s, early 60s. Rock and roll, you know, with Eddie Cochran and all those people, you know, Gene Vincent, Little Richard. I'm a rock and roll guy myself. But I do have the way to sing any kind of song, you know, which is really good. So pleased that I was able to give He and Heavy the way that I sang it was the right way to sing it. As with The Air That I Breathe, what two fantastic songs which were presented to the Hollies, which actually changed people's thoughts about what the Hollies are, you know. Yeah. And I saw One Cool Woman when that went up to America. Number two, I wasn't with the band. I couldn't go over there and promote it. But okay, it made number two. That made me very, very happy, even though I wasn't with the band. All those sort of things were happening within my life to get me to a point now where I've written, I think it's a good album, with Graham singing all the harmonies, sounding like we always used to sing, just that slightly lower voice. But so people are saying now, funnily enough, well, when you start on your third album.
So when are you starting your third album?
Well, I've got a contract with BMG, so you know, I think I'll go till about the day I drop. I don't know. Who knows, you know. I've always lived my life a day at a time. You know, and it's been like that since a certain day in the 60s when I knew it was about time I stopped drinking. And that was a great day that I did that. Mm-hmm. I woke up, you know, and the world changed for me. That's one of the points in my life as well that actually changed my life, changed a lot of people's lives within my family. And I just feel that, you know, I'm doing something which, you know, someone wants, someone will listen to it. You know, I do have a fan base. It's funny, it's called the Alan Clark Appreciation Society. I like the appreciation bit of it, you know. but there's other sites out there as well. So someone is enjoying my music because they're buying it, which is great. Whether I go out and do anything with that in the new year, it all depends on how strong my voice would be to be able to put maybe a half an hour together or three quarters of an hour together and try to do. I think it's possible. You know, there's wonderful things you can do on stage now. I see other guys going out there, you know, and they sound pretty good when they shouldn't be sounding pretty good. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I'm honest about this. If I could get some help, you know, to make it half decent and make it not stressful. You know, because stress is the worst thing you have. You don't want that in your life. And I never would want that in my life again. That would be a possibility. But that would have to be getting this guy involved, that involved, and then getting it together and seeing if it would work. If it worked, then it'd be a yes. But if it didn't, then obviously there wouldn't be any, you know, there wouldn't be any issue.
Absolutely.
I think playing the Albert Hall for one night, that would be great. Just me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Great. And then that would be my farewell to singing. Maybe not just recording, but that would be my farewell to singing.
And what a farewell it would be indeed. I mean, this new album, I'll never forget. It's available to pre-order now, so I recommend everyone gets out there and checks out Alan's website and social medias and all that sort of stuff. There's links everywhere you can get the pre-order, so you can get it when it comes out on April 7th. Now, Alan, if you don't mind taking you back, you've mentioned loads of little bits that I'd love to dive into a little bit now. So let's go back to the cotton mill. I mean, you worked there when you were younger. You and Graham have been trying to make it in bands. I remember speaking to Pete Staples from the Trogs, and he said he was an electrician and he was in someone's house fixing some wiring, and there's his song playing on the radio and he's thinking, why am I doing this when I should be out? So did you have a moment when the cotton mill had to go and you realised it was time to go professional?
No, not at all in my life at all. Graham and I used to work at a company called Kenyon's, and for some misdemeanour we got sacked. And it was about, we wanted to go to one of these holiday camps because we got into the final and we wanted to see if we could win it. We were singing It's Only Make Believe. We won when we were having a holiday there, we won it. So they wanted us to go back. And it was on a Saturday. Unfortunately, we had a half day's work on the Saturday. So we asked the boss if we could have the half day off. And he said no, but we took it. We didn't win it. We came back and we got fired. Graham's dad made him go back, but then I went. I had to go into, so I was more or less about a labourer after that, because the thing that I was supposed to be doing for 5 years was thrown out the window. So you know, Graham and I were in several bands, as you say, and as we were going out at night enjoying ourselves, we both had day jobs. One of my day jobs was working in Howell's Mill in Salford, which is about 100 yards away from where I lived. I went in there being a cook carrier. And when you've been in a mill, especially a cotton mill, and you hear the machines going, chuk, 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 if you can imagine 40 or 50 of those looms in one room continually going. And I had to walk up and down the aisles and go to the looms and cut the full spindles off and take them to the yard where they do other stuff with it. So I got pretty strong doing that. And I enjoyed it as a job, really, because you didn't have to use your brain. Then I went in to be a jacquard cutter, so I worked my way up. And I had to do the looms, you know, the top of the looms, yep, where things come down, where they do the pick threads up to make patterns on certain things. And I used to do the cards for that. And then the mill closed and I was the only guy, I was the last man out, because I was the only guy who knew how to unhook all the looms. So I think it took me about a month to close down Howard's Mill by doing that. So I was at my job then and got another job working it was a store which sold virtually everything. I was on the carpet. I was on the carpet wall. So anyway, in between that, obviously everything happened around in Manchester and in Liverpool. All the groups were coming up doing the stuff that they got from America, like Twist and Shout, and all those, the blues type stuff. Beatles doing all their stuff as well. Going to the Cavern, going to the Twisted Wheel, going to the Three Coins, and also doing private gigs as different kinds of groups. We got to a point where we had a group called the Four Tones. And in that group, everybody that was with that was in the group, the Hollies, except for the guitarist. He was in the Four Tones. So that group went to a place called the Oasis, which was in Manchester, which we played there many times. The Beatles played there. Everybody played there. We used to cross, you know, meet people. And there was no anonymity with any people saying, "Well, quit, let's get over this band," you know, bloody, you know, none of that happened at all. So we got to the Oasis and we just reformed like this band from the Four Tones into this band. Didn't have a name. So when we went on, the guy says, "What are you going to call yourselves?" It was Christmas, just holly leaves all around. And I'm going to say it was me that said it. But I know people will say, "No, I said it." And he said, "Yeah, no, I said it." But I think it was me that said, "Call us the Hollies." And we went on stage as the Hollies that night in 1962. And I think it was December. And so therefore we went out as the Hollies, as a semi-professional group, doing all the same old clubs, but within that, we played more or less all the same song as everybody else. But we always had that difference about me and Graham being in the, we had that particular sound, which everybody loved. So we stood out, you know, from a lot of bands, except the Beatles. Beatles got Love Me Do, and they became very, very famous overnight. And they were a great success. It changed the attitude about music and what kind of people were playing it. You know, actually, these were people from up north. You know, we talk funny, you know, and they say things. And then when they had a big hit after that, all the producers down in London wanted their equivalent of the Beatles. So they came to see us at the Cavern one night. EMI, Ron Richards, who later became our producer, saw us on the Cavern, said, right, come down to EMI Recording Studios, which of course is now Abbey Road. And we did an audition, mainly doing all the songs that we do on stage. And they said, yeah, okay, we'll sign you. And that was it. Overnight, I was a professional singer in a professional group, signed to EMI, and having a hit record with, Ain't That Just Like Me? Something like that. And Searching, we did a lot of coaster songs. Yeah. They were the first two singles. And my life changed overnight. And you know, from what I came from, and I had a great childhood. I was the last of a family of seven kids. And my mum and dad and my grandma in one house, you know, in two bedrooms, three downstairs, and like a little kitchen and a loo out in the yard. Of course, that didn't mean anything to me other than this is where I lived. This is how it was. I never felt that I was being, you know, I couldn't have this and I couldn't have that. There were things that I couldn't have, but I accepted it. And, you know, my life as a kid was great. So getting into somewhere where you can go into a hotel and you can fill a bath up as much as you want with hot water, you know, never ever had that before. It was all somewhere in it where you go for a bath up in, you know, and you have to, the guy says, how much water going in, round, you know, that bit. Fill a bath with 6 inches of water, you know. That was part of my life then. But that was one thing changed. But a lot of things changed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the Beatles there. You probably get asked this all the time, but you guys were from Manchester. There's obviously a big rivalry between Liverpool and Manchester and everything, music, sport, life, the world, everything. You were welcomed, though, weren't you, by the Liverpoolians and by the Cavern Club? I mean, how did all that go down?
Well, you just got on stage and we just did what we did. And they all went, yeah, you know, wow, and all this bit. You know, they loved us. You know, every time we went there, the place was packed. But, you know, there was nothing like that with us and the Beatles. I mean, what was it? What happens in the band when you turn professional? You've got bookings that you've made for places that you don't really want to play when you're famous. But you have to do them because you're contracted. And I remember in Stoke-on-Trent, we were on the bill with the Beatles. And we were in the same dressing room because there was only one dressing room. And of course, you know, how you doing and all that, blah, 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 what you're going on, going, what you're doing, what songs, because we didn't want to repeat, you know, because that's usually what would happen. And I remember being there and the two guys, Paul and John, got the guitars out and started strumming about, started writing a song. And they said, yeah, come over and help us write this song. So Graham and I went over there and we put a word in there and again and a little change there. Not too much, not too drastic or anything like that. And they said, oh, all right, thanks for that. I'm still waiting for the contract to arrive, which never did. And that song was Misery.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, so there was nothing like saying, I was having to ring him up and say, hey, we want our money. Do nothing like that. You always did things for the love of it. I mean, I remember Paul coming down a couple of times, asking me to go on and do a few harmonies on what he was doing, which, yeah, of course, you go and do that. And it was no hardship. You were just pals. The one album that I worked on there was Back to the Egg, which was solo things. And he gave everybody on that album a gold bracelet for Back to the Egg. I lost mine.
Oh, no.
Lost it. Yeah. And he was in Wimbledon somewhere. But I put my coat down there, the car, and it must have just come off and fell on the floor. Yeah, one of the worst things that's happened to me in my life. I've just lost it. But not to worry. I have it all back up here, what I did and what Paul asked me to do. And I was all going down to the studio when he was there, tinkling away with the piano, writing songs and that. And it's not as if, hey, go out, you can't listen to this. No, we were pals. I used to go up to, Paul used to have a birthday party, which was Buddy's birthday party every year. And we'd go down there and we'd get on stage and sing together, have drinks, we'd meet all the other guys that liked Buddy Holly. And that happened once a year. And then I don't think it happened after that since Linda died. But that was a good gig, I remember being on stage with Paul and me. And unfortunately, Gary Glitter was there as well. Put him off all the photographs. So, then it was like, wow. Tim Rice was there, lots of other people, not just for songwriters as well, not just people who perform. Yeah, I always look forward to that. But no. There was no nastiness between anybody. No. I mean, John was a bit, he's a bit cheap. He'd always try and put me down, but in a nice way.
I've heard that a few times. So in terms of the Hollies then, I mean, you had so many hits here in the UK in those early years. I mean, from 1963, there was, I think it was 9 top 10 singles in the space of just 3 years, one of them being a number one, I'm Alive. And then the cracking of America came with the hit Bus Stop in 1966. Now, it's an interesting story behind this one because it was written by a future star, 10cc's Graham Goldman, but he was only young at the time.
Yeah,
he was. Tell us about that one.
I wasn't there when Graham went to see it. He was like us, he was lived in, I didn't see it, so I don't know whether it was a rough area or not. But the one thing that Graham said was that when he was introduced to, it was this young kid, he must have been about 16, is this young kid was being like 22, whatever. And he said, he just went this song, that's, and I said, I'll have that one. I mean, we chose Lutz and Winnie Window and Bus Stop. There was another one called Schoolgirl we did, which went out on one of the albums later on. And I prefer that to Bus Stop and to Look Through a New Window. And Graham's done really well on that song. I mean, that's one of the songs that's on the BBC playlist, and it's been that there forever, which is and alongside of Ian Headley's My Brother and The Air That I Breathe. They seem to have forgotten about Gasoline, Ally Bray, I'll Let Go. And all those sort of songs that went before that. But there you go. So it's all down there now in the vaults. History is there. Yeah. Graham Gorman. Yeah, and then he went on to be 10cc. Wonderful. I mean, great songwriter.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And then more kind of hits came after that as well. Stop, Stop, Stop on Carousel, as you said, Carry On, etc. But despite the success of the band, Graham was hooked by the West Coast of America, really, wasn't he, at this stage? And he decided to leave the band. I mean, how did you feel? Because you, like we said, you'd been friends since the age of 6. I mean, how did it feel when he decided to leave? And was it something that you could foresee coming?
No, I didn't see it coming at all.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them? was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Until much later on, and I was actually stopped in the street by a friend and said, did you know that Graham's forming a group in America?
All right.
And I didn't know. Graham does say that he left a few clues along the way, but you don't think about that thing happening, you know, when you've been together for that length of time. There was a lot of thing happening in America that we went over to America. And when we got to Los Angeles, we were doing a gig at the Whiskey Go Go, and everybody was there. You know, and when I mean everybody, whoever they could get in that was famous, they got in. And we did a great show. And after that, I think Graham met up with Crosby, Stills. I don't think Neil was there. No, but they came back to the Beverly Comstock where we were staying. And I was in a suite with Graham, so I was really tired. To be honest, I wasn't interested. You know, they were just going to do a bit of jamming, and that was it. And I think that's where the sound was formed. I think that's what Graham fell in love with. He fell in love with the sound. Now, before that, we made an album called Butterfly. Mm-hmm. Which is an album which Graham wanted to take further somewhere, which we didn't know about. And some of the songs he sang on his own with his own harmonies. And the album was okay, but I think Graham was trying to do something more other than the Hollies were capable of by doing the thing on his own. I thought that was a bit strange, but you know, sometimes you say, well, let people have their way and get it out of their system and see what happens. But it went a bit further than that, you see. And I think the next time that we went to Los Angeles, Mama Cass was on the scene. Graham had made friends with Mama Cass, and he'd been in the recording studio with her. I can only think about what happened now by knowing the truth and the people that were around at that particular time, that Graham was actually doing things with other people. But in my mind, I never thought he was going to do it with the in mind to sort of leave. Anyway, when I found out, I went to him and said, is this true? And he said, well, unfortunately, it is. Obviously, the rest of the boys were involved, and we tried to have a meeting to persuade him not to go, but that was never going to happen. And he said, no, I'm going, and I'm going now. And I was quite devastated in a way, thinking about, well, oh, what do I do now then? I've lost my best mate. I've lost the guy who sang harmony with. They were famous, you know, doing that. What do I do? For the weeks after that, I was, you know, I couldn't really care about anything, to be honest. I was really down. And then I did, one day he just said to me, oh, hey, I was the lead singer. I'm the lead singer. So that, for the, you know, I had something in this group. So maybe we'll go out and we'll find somebody who sings just like Graham. Terry Sylvester came along. And I did a few things with him, and we blended.
Yeah.
You know, not in a friendship kind of way to start off with, but his voice. When I started singing, he jumped in. He must have done his homework somewhere, but I don't care about that. He sounded great. I thought, wow, okay, let's go in the studios. We were doing a Bob Dylan album at that particular time. He was on the Bob Dylan album. At the same time, we recorded Sorry Suzanne, which was just like going back to like Carrie Ann and Jennifer Eccles, you know, and this one, thinking, well, it's a pop song. That's what we're known for. We tried it that way. It didn't work. So let's just go back to that and see what happens. And it was a top 10 hit straight away. Well, you know, it still took me a while to forget what Graham did, because I don't think that he thought about what would happen to me when he left me, you know, because I may not have ever found Terry Sylvester. You know what I mean? It might not have happened that way. Mm-hmm. And I hate to think of what I would have turned out to be maybe in those years. I probably could have gone out as a solo singer, but, I've always needed guys around me because we've always been close-knit, you know. But I didn't go that way. And later on, we actually made some really brilliant records, which, you know, I mean, even Graham said on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame DVD, not the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it was the Invasion, British Invasion, that we did, a documentary type thing, him saying that how dare they have a hit up to number ones after I left, how dare they? He was a bit surprised, more than surprised, that actually we had more than two hits. I think we had four or five or six after he left, which I think is about six more than needed. I'd forgotten all that had gone in the past. You know, I was successful with the rest of the Hollies, so my life was really good. So we carried on from, I mean, the last hit we had was The Air That I Breathe. And, you know, we were doing good tours. We were going out and doing tours. We became a touring band like most people did. Because people loved us, they wanted to see us, so we did it. You know, I suppose if we hadn't got full bookings everywhere we went, we'd have given up. You know, it was a lifestyle that came.
Yeah.
And the years went by, and He and Heavy was a hit again in 1989, I think. If you would have thought that happened from a Miller Lite advert, you know, good God, you know, it's a spiritual song. It's not for selling beer. But, you know, they just carried on after that even more because of that, you know, that advert in a sorry way, really. Yeah. Until actually my voice gave out. And my story has been what we've been talking about from then on.
Absolutely. And as you said, that went to number one. It was an incredible hit for you. But another big hit we have to touch on as well, Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress. I mean, it is just a rock and roll classic. But it was written quite quickly, wasn't it? And originally, I think I'd heard you said it was just an album song, wasn't it? It wasn't meant to be this all-conquering single.
No, I started writing with Roger Cook, you know, Blue Mink.
Yeah.
Fabulous writer. He said to me one day, do you fancy writing a song? I said, yeah, why not? We met at the Air, the producers for Air producers. That was George Martin, Ron Richards, and I forget who the other two are now. But we went to their offices and sat down in the basement where there was a piano, which wasn't touched. I took my guitar down, my little tablet, and I said, well, why, have you got any ideas? He says, well, I've got this one idea. He hadn't got it there completed or anything like that. So, you know, I would have done it. Or my name wouldn't have been on it, let's put it that way. I had my guitar and I started doing a sort of a rhythm. And then he said, I'd like to make this song about a detective in America, you know, that gets involved with this woman. And we worked our way through it to get to the point where it was Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress with my intro and my guitar chugging away there all the way through it, which is one of the main things in the actual whole song. But it was done in a way that it came very quickly. When I say quickly, it was about half an hour to three quarters of an hour. And in that, we drank a bottle of brandy. You know, so we weren't that serious about it was going to go anywhere. But I took it to the boys, and again, it was in the studios, and I played them this, and says, "Oh, that sounds really good." We were doing the Distant Light album. Tony said, "Well, you can play it. You play it." I know why he said that now. But anyway, I put my guitar down with Bobby on drums and Bernie on bass. And then I did a vocal, I did two, and we picked the first one and in the mix. Tony put some more rhythm guitar on it to keep it together. Ron Richards didn't produce it. There was no harmonies on it. We went, took it into the engineer. The engineer said, "I put some slap echo on it." We hadn't even mixed it, you know. So I put some slap echo. "Well, tell me what you think." He said, "That's it. Just leave it. And don't do any more, you know." Ron Richards heard it the day after, and he says, "You've got to take the slap echo off." I said, "I'm not doing that." He says, well, "It's not going on the album." I said, "No, you can't say that. It's going to go on the album." And he said, "Well, okay, then I'll go on the album with the slap echo." He said, "No one will understand what you're singing." I said, "It's rock and roll, you know." So anyway, I'd left the group. Again, it was one of those things where I wanted to do an album. I was writing with Roger Cook. I was writing with Tony McCauley, you know, and other people, and I was getting songs similar to the, Long Cool Woman. And I think, "Oh, I think I'll do a solo album. Guys, I want to do a solo album. Is that all right?" "No." "Oh, well, why not?" "Because if you do that, you'd be like Graham, you'll leave." So I said, "I won't leave. I don't want to leave. I just want to do a solo album." He said, "Well, if you do that, you'll have to leave the group." So virtually they sacked me.
Wow. So I was going to say, the story behind that is that the song then got later released after you'd left the band.
Yes, and it was number two. Well, you know, I got a guy around me from America and said, "I want to publish this song that you've written called Little Cool Woman." I said, "Well, why?" He says, "Well, it's going up the charts. You need someone to look after it." I said, "Okay." And then when it had reached number two, I thought, well, maybe I should be going out and actually doing this promotion. So I did get in touch, and they said, "No, you can't do that." And the Hollies went to America forget his name now, but they had another singer. I must put this in that they had hits with this singer who was Swedish. His English was not all that good. But anyway, I didn't get to America to do that. And I think that was one of the worst things that the Hollies ever did to themselves, because if they'd have had me in the band when they went there, then it would have meant a lot more. It would have opened up the Americans to us to actually become bigger than we were because of that particular song. But because of, they wouldn't let me do that, I think, you know, they let themselves down that one. But anyway, what happened was Tony came after a couple of years and said, "Look, you know, we got to have you back. You know, you just can't do it without you." So I said, "I didn't want to leave in the first place, Tony. So really, maybe you've wasted 3 years and I've wasted 3 years. So, you know, okay, let's do it." Well, I got back and we had a hit.
Yeah.
Right up until, you know, the year that I read. And again, everything goes from that to the rest of history to this particular day. But Long Cool Woman was something which has gone on all the way through my life. You know, obviously been in, I don't know how many films it's been in. It's, you know,
ridiculous.
But I can say that about The Air That I Breathe and Ian Heavy and a lot of other Hollies hits which have been in films. And that's good when you do that. Actually, a lot of people recognise you by seeing a film.
Yeah.
They go, who is that? Oh, and they go out and buy records. So, yeah, life's funny in that way.
It's absolutely fantastic. And just one last thing that you touched on earlier as well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you're inducted in 2010. I mean, talk to me about that, because that is an incredible achievement for many British bands to go over. And I've spoken to many people that have been inducted. So tell me about your experience of that kind of the nominations and then getting inducted and then the night itself.
Well, the thing about that is Graham persuaded me to do it because I didn't think that I could sing. And if I went there with a show like that, which was so big, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it's very important when it goes out and billions of people watch it. I didn't want to go on there and make a fool of myself or even make a fool of Graham or anybody else that was there. So my first reaction to that was, Graham, I can't do it. I can't sing. And he said, well, he said, don't worry about that. I said, well, I do. He says, well, don't. He says, just come over. He says, enjoy it, and we'll make it work. Well, okay. That was my main thought, we'll make it work. Wrong Tony and Bobby, no, they didn't want to do it. As I say, you know, they should have done it, but they didn't. So the next thing was that Jenny and I was on a plane going over to New York with Toby, my son, because he couldn't have missed out on anything like that. And we get to the Waldorf Hotel by limousine cars, which was, you know, it was really well, you know, it's important. It's well done with my name on it. So I really felt important and got to the Waldorf, got into the rooms, and then they says, well, we want you to go down and meet the band. And Graham's up there waiting for you. So I went in, and as I walked into it, everybody clapped. Said, hey, Alan Clark's come in the room.
Wow.
And I thought, they do that sort. I didn't think that they did that sort in America, but they do. And, you know, Graham came over and gave me a hug, and I got on stage, and these two other guys were standing on stage with me. And there was the Paul Ritchie Band, you know, which is absolutely fabulous. We were going to do Bus Stop and Long Cool Woman. And he introduced me to the two guys, unbeknown to me, that the lead singer of Maroon 5 was there and then the lead singer of Train, you know. And I said, well, he said, but they're going to help with you know, they're going to help you get through it. I thought, well, you better try it, you know. So my son was there in the audience. It wasn't an audience, it was empty, you know. And I said, Let me know if it's crap or it's not, you know. So we did Bust Up, and I think it was the adrenaline.
Yeah.
Knowing that I had these two. I really didn't. They weren't actually that famous then, I don't think. You know, it was only after that that they Move Like Jagger came out and blah, blah, blah. And they really had good voices, especially the guy in Train, because he did the Long Cool Woman one with me.
Yeah.
And I looked at my son. My son went, I thought, oh, that sounded pretty good. So I was there and I was singing and everybody went, that was great. If it had been crap, right, it would have said so, but it wasn't. And I think it wasn't crap because I had the two guys giving me the confidence to be able to actually push myself forward without caring, you know, and doing it without thinking, I think, is the way to do something like that. Instead of stressing all the time. They took the stress away completely. So the guitarist for Long Cool Woman, there were two guitarists in the group, and one of them says, we're doing Long Cool Woman, but we can't do the intro, Alan. And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, there's something there that we're missing. He says, and everybody else that we know can't play it either. I says, well, I got it. The riff has been around for a long, long time. So sure, you must be able to do it. He says, no, we can't do it. There's a note missing, which we don't know how you do it and where you get it from. And what it is, it's just a flick on one, twice on one string, which you can't see when you're doing it. So it down, diddle-dum, down, diddle-dum, down, diddle-dum, down. And it's the diddle-dum they couldn't get. Couldn't see how they did it. So when I showed them, they went, oh, that's easy. You know, I said, yeah, it's easy now, isn't it? You know, you know, laughter. You know, it was something that was joyful. And then we went to bed, and the next morning was the day that we went down and did a first rehearsal, which we went through. And then, you know, in the afternoon, it was the start of the big thing. We went down. We were in the audience at our own table with Graham and his family, and Toby and myself. And the people went on and came off. And then it was our turn. And they came to collect us and we went on stage. And it was like when we were introduced, it was... And actually the guy, what's his name now? Van Dance?
Yeah. Stevie Van Zandt, yeah.
Stevie Van Dance was the guy who'd actually enabled us to get to the point where we were inducted. Along with a lot of other names, because you really get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, all the people that are already there, if they're still alive, vote for who's going to be in. You see, so all the people voted for the Hollies to be in it. And Stevie, he was great. He was playing guitar with us. He knew how to play it.
Yeah, of course.
You know. And he was great because, you know, Bruce Springsteen, we had something, you know, together. And we did the show and it went down tremendously well. And I was thinking to myself, well, that was a bloody miracle. It just came out of it from nowhere. And it was a for 4 days we were there. And it was thoroughly enjoyable, you know, being with Graham and his family and the rest of the family couldn't come because of kids and things like that. And we had a really good time. And with Graham, it was, well, see you the next time. And I went home and I was really glad that I took his advice. And those two guys were there to help me through it. But I did feel myself that I did actually do my own. A good job doing it, and then that was the end of it. Then it was back home doing what I normally do in my family. You know, it's crazy. Those things happen to people.
Yeah, absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, went from a guy from the mill. You know, all of a sudden he's on. Yeah.
Fantastic stuff. And you say a guy from the mill. One last story, if you don't mind indulging me, Alan. I know I've taken up a lot of your time, but I heard you once tell a story about getting to see Elvis Presley live in concert in Las Vegas. The funny anecdote about being in the line and having your tickets and things like that. Would you mind telling that story again?
Well, that was funny because I was recording in Los Angeles and I was with Elvis, his drummer. He was drumming for me on my session. And I actually said to him, I said, it'd be nice to see Elvis. I got a couple of days off, you know, if I could get there. And he says, well, what do you want to do? You want to see Jerry Weintraub? He's the guy who does it all. And the guy the guy that was producing it heard it and came down, said, I know, Jerry, if you want to go and see Elvis, I'll get you tickets. And he said, yeah, VIP tickets. I thought, oh, great, wonderful. But it's not far to Las Vegas. And when we got to the point, the owner of the studio said, you can use my house. You know, I thought, well, I pray. So we had a house, which was a really decent house, and we were going to see Elvis. So on the night, we go there, and we go up to the maitre d', whose queues are down there. And then I show him the tickets, and he says, yes, sir. He says, stand in the queue. I said, stand in the queue. He said, yes, stand in the queue. And I said, but these are VIP tickets. He says, yes, stand in the queue. So I thought, this is not right. So, you know, you do one of those double takes and thinking, I've got to try one more time. I said, no, I said, this is Jerry who sent us VIPs. And he said, yes, sir, stand in the VIP queue. The queue that I didn't look down, I was too eager to get in. There was all like people that I recognised who stood in this queue, so we had to stand in the queue. Fortunately for me was that when we went in, the maitre d' had made sure that we got a table right at the front, so I was like, wow. I was 3 feet away from Elvis at one time. I mean, he looked terrible, but if you closed your eyes, it was just unbelievable. His voice was absolutely fantastic. And he didn't actually come over our way to the stage and stood in front of us. You know, and he was doing that thing with the cloth and doing his head and passing them out. And I thought, I think I'm gonna get one of those. Yeah, I can get Elvis's DNA. All these things are going through my head when we're going. And he came over and he got the scarf off and held it, and I went like that. And all of a sudden, you know, I reached out for it and I got pulled back very strongly. And I looked back and my wife had pulled me back. And I said, what do you do that for? She said, don't be silly. He says, that's for women, not for men. But I've had, you know, it's just one of those things that would have been nice to sort of bring on. This is Elvis's scarf. But what silly things that you do when you, you know, you're enjoying yourself. I'll never forget that. I went back to the coffee shop when it was all over, and Elvis's drummer was there, and I said, any chance of getting upstairs and meeting the big man? He said, you don't want to, Alan. He says, you remember him how you want to remember him. You don't want to go upstairs, which was a shame. Yeah, I remember that as well. At least I got to see him, and I nearly got scars.
Well, Alan, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I've loved this last hour or so. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. It really has.
What a fascinating storyteller, so open and honest. Please check out his new work with Graham Nash. Buddy's back, the single is available to listen to and stream, etc., and all that sort of stuff now. And the album is available to pre-order too, so please do get involved and help him out. Right, it's the time of the show for this week's top five, and of course it's going to be my favourite five songs from the Hollies. Last week's top five was my favourite five Kansas songs, thanks to the big interview I did with Kansas guitarist Rich Williams. A big thanks to everyone who was in touch during the week with their favourite Kansas songs. Joe K says Fight Fire with Fire is a great track. Becky Salerno and Vicky Cowan Hayes both said that their favourites were Play the Game Tonight and Point of No Return. Lazars Live, or is it Lazars Live? I'm not sure. Said Song for America and Hopelessly Human. And Terence Dane agrees with Carry On Wayward Son and also said that Dust in the Wind has to be number two. David Davies, I don't think it's the Kinks guitarist, but there you go. His top five were Lamplight Symphony, The Wall, What's on My Mind, Song for America, and Summer. A big thanks to everyone for getting in touch with your choices this week. So on to the Hollies then, and I'm a big fan of the Merseybeat sound, and although they were from Manchester, they had that style for sure. A lot of their early songs were played constantly in my house when I was younger, and I remember wearing out a cassette I had with loads of Merseybeat favourites on there. So this is a personal list, not a kind of critic's choice kind of thing. I don't expect you to fully agree with it. In fact, I'd love to hear how you would disagree with it. Message me on the socials or email vintagerockpod@gmail.com. during the week, and I'll give you a mention on next week's programme. So, let's see what you make of these then. My favourite five songs from the Hollies. At five is a brilliant sing-along song that was written about Marianne Faithfull, according to an interview with Graham Nash. Big hit for the group, going to number three in the UK and number nine in both America and Canada in 1967. At number five is Carrie Anne. At number four is a beautiful song that was written by Bob Russell and Bobby Scott. The piano on the original recording of this from 1969 was played by Elton John, who was a session musician at the time. It was a big hit in 1969, peaking at three in the UK and seven in the US, before refinding fame in 1988, going to number one in the UK for 2 weeks. At number four is He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother. He ain't heavy. At number three is an early one, reaching number two in the UK in 1964. It's another infectious song with fantastic harmonies between Alan Graham and Tony. And number three is Just One Look. Just one look. Number two is their first hit in America, where it reached number five, same as it did in the UK, although it was a big number one hit in Canada. Originally written by a young Graham Gouldman, who would go on to find fame in 10cc. And number two is Bus Stop. Bus stop, where day she's there, I say, reshare my umbrella. Bus stop, bus go, she stays, love grows under my umbrella. And at number one for me is their rockier number. It's a great song, which is different to many of their other hits, as it doesn't feature the famous three-part harmonies. No, from the album Distant Light, my favourite song from the Hollies is Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress. So there you go, my top five songs from the Hollies. As always, I'd love to hear what you think. What's your favourite track of theirs? Message me on the social media platforms. Look out for the post during the week. Or you can email me, vintagerockpod@gmail.com. I'll give you a mention on next week's programme, I will. And remember to check out Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and YouTube for all the Vintage Rock Pod latest. Well, that's it for me, though. This week's big interview show has been a big one indeed. Thank you very much for listening to it. Make sure you subscribe to Vintage Rock Pod on your podcast app so that you get all the episodes that are released every single day, remember. And I'll be back tomorrow with another This Day Rocks. So until then, take care.
Hey, Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.